From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As the United States Congress tackles the question of economic aid tailored to the pandemic's devastation, there is still a blind spot on how our economic system is designed to be unequal. While the pandemic increased inequality, it also exposed the pitfalls of pre-existing inequality. A large majority of Americans, even before 2020, had less than $1,000 of savings. Wages had stagnated for those lucky enough to still have a job. And today, hunger is so rampant that food banks are struggling to keep up with the demand. Women and people of color are, of course, far more vulnerable. Poverty remains invisible in the United States, and my next two guests are determined to change that. Joanne Goldblum is CEO and founder of the National Diaper Bank Network and the Alliance for Period Supplies. Colleen Shaddix is a journalist focusing on criminal justice reform and inequality. She's written for the New York Times, the Washington Post, and NPR. The two of them are co-authors of the new book we're now discussing, Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. Welcome to the program, Joanne and Colleen.
Thank you very much.
Joanne, let me start with you. Tell me a little bit about your work and how you have seen poverty. As I mentioned, poverty is somewhat invisible in the U.S. We have this fantasy that if we just all work hard enough, we're going to, you know, be rich, and that rich people are just our future selves. But meanwhile, we have rampant poverty in the world's richest nation. What sort of evidence have you seen with your own eyes of American poverty?
Right, and I think that you really described it quite well. We do live in an incredibly segregated society where people who are not poor rarely see what poverty really looks like. I'm a social worker, and you know, have been, I think, for my whole life, but I began to really think about the issue of basic needs and material basic needs and the way that the United States addresses poverty. Well, I was working at Yale Child Study Center doing what we call community-based social work. So I went to people's homes. Basically, I worked with people where they were. And they had a variety of different things going on in their lives, you know, different mental health issues, substance use issues, you know, just general things that made life more difficult. But what they all had in common was a level of poverty that, even as somebody who thought that they understood what poverty in America looked like, I was shocked. You know, I remember working with a mom, a developmentally disabled mom who had three children, and they never had toilet paper in the house. And as a clinician, you know, I would think about it and think about, well, why doesn't she have toilet paper? What is it that I could do to help with that? And what has become clear to me, and really the essence of the work that I do, is there is no clinical intervention available for toilet paper. If somebody doesn't have toilet paper, what you can do is buy it for them. There is no amount of pulling yourself up by your bootstraps that allows you access to the things that you need. And as a social worker, you know, we're taught to maintain boundaries, to not give people things because of, as you said earlier, this idea that Americans have that everybody should have to work to get what they deserve. And if they don't get it through work, they don't deserve it. You know, so we really found, you know, I really just became obsessed with this idea that that just wasn't true. And so through that work and being, you know, privileged to have people allow me to come into their homes and see what was going on, I began to realize that there just was no support for these things for people. And so I began to research it, and you know, my husband and a few good friends and I started giving diapers to people. And that's what became eventually, you know, so much of the work that I do.
So, Colleen, let me ask you this. We have been told, especially over the past 4 years during Trump's reign, that the economy was improving. Of course, we know that, especially as revealed during 2020, that the stock market is absolutely not a measure of the economy, as it remained booming while unemployment soared. But still, there were plenty of Americans, probably millions, maybe tens of millions, the ones who voted for Donald Trump, who truly believed that the economy was improving under Trump. So how do you reconcile the fact that poverty has remained rampant, even pre-pandemic in America, with this notion that actually the economy was getting better?
Well, I think there's a few reasons for it. One of, I got to lay it on the feet of journalists like myself, who I think don't always do a terrific job. The stock market is reported on so exhaustively as if that were the economy, and it's clearly not. Another thing that we don't do very well is report on unemployment numbers. There were times when it was down near 4% during the Trump administration where it would be reported as de facto full employment. That wasn't true. Unemployment is always higher in communities of color than it is in America as a whole. And how people whose job was reporting on the economy couldn't see that was beyond me. The other thing is that we have really associated having a job with being okay. That's not true.
Our standards are too low.
Most people in poverty work. Mm-hmm. You know, but they don't work in a way that pays their bills. And that's not their fault. That's because real wages haven't gone up in this country since the 1970s.
So let's, going back to you, Joanne, let's talk about some of the specifics that you cite in your book. One is that there is this, you know, basic notion, as Colleen was just saying, as long as you're okay and you're surviving, you've made it, except that there are people who are not even surviving in America today. You write in your book about access to the most basic building block of life, and that is water. How is it that in the world's richest nation, people still struggle to have access to water?
So I really appreciate the way you asked that question, because it is so stark. You know, the reason that people in America still struggle with water is because our infrastructure is broken. And what we know and learned so much more about in researching this book is that there are many areas of the country where, you know, we've all heard about Flint. We don't hear
Flint,
about
Michigan.
All of the,
yeah.
Flint, Michigan, where, you know, the water is poisonous to the residents there. That's true in many other areas as well. And it is particularly true in communities of color. The infrastructure is worse in poorer communities and communities of color throughout the country. And when it comes to water, you know, there was a 2017 study from the University of Michigan that showed 1 in 10 Americans are not able to pay their water bill regularly. That's a huge number. You know, so many of us think, even though we pay a water bill, we sort of think, well, water's free. You know, there's a disconnect. And, you know, it's not. And we interviewed somebody, a man in Baltimore, who told us that he spends $20 a week on bottled water to flush his toilet.
Wow.
And the other thing that we learned is that there are places in the country, particularly on Indian reservations, where large portions of the population don't have running water, don't have indoor plumbing. And that's in the United States. And, you know, I think that what Colleen and I believe about this is that a lot of it has to do with racism, and that is so embedded into the way that we as a country think. So it's there are just so many different aspects to it. But yes, in America, many people don't have water. You know, this the family that I mentioned earlier, you know, that I was working with that sort of opened my eyes to so much of this. They sometimes in the winter, they didn't have heat and hot water. That's in Connecticut, right? It's cold here. And there's no law that requires utilities to provide people with utilities when they are necessary.
So in addition to requiring water for survival, we of course require food. And we know that the, as I mentioned, food banks, especially during the pandemic, are overstretched. There's just a huge and increasing demand for food and food aid. There is, of course, a government program, the SNAP, Benefit Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or colloquially known as food stamps, which Trump, in spite of his populist rhetoric, repeatedly has tried to cut, had tried to cut during his tenure. How serious an issue has hunger been in the United States? Colleen, let me ask this of you. And did our, you know, food stamp program, was it adequate to address the issue? I recently recall reading that the cost to the government of the food stamp program from last year alone skyrocketed because demand was so high. Was it enough to meet the need?
No, there has never been enough to meet the need. Most of those food banks, like most homeless shelters in the United States, came into existence during the Reagan administration. He really slashed the social safety net, and nonprofits gamely entered the field to try and make up the difference, but they cannot. They just don't have the scale. The only institution in America that's big enough to end poverty is the United States government, and indeed, it could. You know, the child allowance that's being proposed now as part of Biden's COVID relief plan is going to cost less than the Trump tax cut did. We do give money to people. We just tend to give it to rich people. And the money we spend on people in poverty tends to be responses to catastrophes that are very expensive and very painful for people. The money we spend in emergency rooms, we spend in prisons, instead of spending on making sure that every American child went to school well-nourished enough to thrive.
But trickle-down economics, that's what, of course, we've been told for the past 50 years. There was a recent study by the by researchers at the London School of Economics that studied not just the United States, but dozens of other countries, where this notion that if you throw money at the rich, it will trickle down to the poor, and that's a way for prosperity for all. That notion was tested and found to have failed in every single case. So I want to take on this and follow up from the question that we raised, Joanne, around hygiene and just being able to, you know, flush one's toilets. There are people in America without access to water. And of course, I immediately think of how women and young women and girls are dealing with this. And it's a taboo subject that often doesn't get raised in connection to poverty. You talk about it front and center in your book, and that is that women and girls menstruate, and we need access to water. We need access to supplies, menstrual, you know, supplies, tampons and sanitary pads. How does poverty impact especially women when it comes to menstruation?
You know, we at the National Diaper Bank Network started a program called the Alliance for Period Supplies. And we did that because period poverty is a huge issue in the United States. And like water, it's something that we think as a society is relegated to developing countries. You know, we know
people here in the US would raise money for women and girls in other countries to have access to period supplies.
Right. And we think here it's, you know, that it's not a problem. But we know from schools and from different research that's been done that women and girls and menstruators of all kinds.
Yes. Thank you for clarifying that. Yes.
Miss school and work. because they don't have the products they need. And the issue of hygiene is, I think, incredibly interesting because we tend to ignore it as a societal ill, right? That people don't have access to the things they need. But when it comes to interacting with our fellow people, our fellow humans, somebody with bad hygiene, you notice right away. And people whose clothes are dirty, whose bodies are dirty, who, you know, they don't have the same opportunities. You know, I always think of myself as a pretty easygoing employer. But if someone were to come to my office and they had their period and didn't have, weren't using a product, I'd be hard pressed to hire them, right? I mean, that's just not acceptable. You know, and the same goes for, you know, dirty clothes and, you know, clean hair. These are expectations that we have of anybody that we interact with. And yeah.
I want to pick up on what you said, because there's an underlying theme here that's related to the invisibility of poverty in America, and that is shame. The notion of poverty and its resulting consequences being the fault of the individual, and therefore generating such a deep shame, a collective shame, that we don't talk about it openly, and therefore it becomes invisibilized. It becomes just a matter of personal responsibility. You're poor because it's your fault. You don't have access to food and water or period supplies because you're too poor to have them. They're shame. How deep is that, and how much of an impediment is it to progress, Colleen?
Oh, it's huge. It's the crux of the issue. Speaking about water, I interviewed a woman who grew up in a Navajo community. They did not have water in their house. Once a week, they carted water to fill up the bathtub. All the kids took a bath, and after that, they washed clothes in that same water. She didn't smell very good during much of the week. She got teased in school a lot, and she quit. You know, that's not surprising. We associate cleanliness with goodness, and we, to some extent, associate having money with goodness. There are a lot of people who believe that prosperity is a sign that you're living right. You know, we met plenty of people who were living right, but they just weren't getting paid right. And so they couldn't get out of poverty. But it's much easier for us to blame people in poverty for their own situation than it is for us to actually look at our systems and structures and say, hey, something has to change here. But that is the fact. Something has to change. Remember talking to one man who kept saying during the interview, I'm a good person. I really am a good person. And wow. I thought, why is he saying that? He hasn't told me anything that indicates otherwise. But he thought that the fact that he was talking about not having a home, not having a steady job, though he did lots of pickup work at construction sites, he thought that he would appear like a bad person in my eyes. And I don't think that that's an unfounded fear. I think he would appear like a bad person in many people's eyes.
I'm wondering if you can comment on the same. Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to add to that. You know, we did, the National Diaper Bank Network did a study with our colleagues at Yale University about diaper need. And one of the things that was most striking about what we found is that maternal stress and depression was more highly correlated with diaper need than any other material deficit. So not being able to change your baby when they're dirty made mothers specifically feel anxious and depressed. And that's not surprising. And it goes to what you started the conversation with by talking about shame. You know, as a parent, as a guardian, somebody taking care of a child, your job, your first job, the most basic job, is to keep that child clean and healthy.
And right? So many of these are sort of notions that are embedded in this libertarian ideal that has infected American society and discourse and government, that government should stay out of, you know, actually doing its job, which is taking our tax dollars and using them to help us. And instead, we all should be on our own because somehow earned riches, even though the rich usually don't earn their riches, are more noble. And relying on government support is a shameful thing. Let's talk about solutions in the last part of our conversation, which, of course, is the most important part of this. We know poverty is an issue in America, even if it's not always visible. Colleen, what are the ways and what are the solutions that you explore in the book you've co-written with Joanne Goldblum on how we can tackle this? I mean, an obvious solution seems to be to tax the rich. We know who has the money, who has lots of it, who doesn't need it. We just have to take it from them. Why not just tax the rich and use it to help the rest of us?
Why not? I think that's a great idea. One reason that that doesn't happen is because we have this broken political system where our representatives depend on the contributions of wealthy people to maintain office. So they tend to work in their interest, not even in a evil way, but because that's who they talk to all day. But the core of the book is that poverty is a gap between what you need and what you have. So the government can make up for that in a lot of ways. A progressive taxation system, encouraging a raise in the minimum wage, universal basic income. And there are also a lot of micro things that people can do on the local level to even out the playing field a bit for people of all income levels. And we go through a zillion of those in the book. You don't have to be powerful or rich or a well-positioned advocate to do something. Everybody can do something to make America a more economically fair place.
Joanne, tell me also what you think needs to happen now in terms of advocacy, in terms of changing the cultural conversation to change our political system, because so much of it has to do with how our narratives are written.
Right. And so I'd start by saying, you know, to go back to the question that you asked Colleen about why don't we just tax the rich, you know, part of what has to happen, aside from taxing more, is spending differently. Because right now, you know, if we were just to be taxed more, but didn't change how money was spent, all it would do is take away from nonprofits and not step in. You know, if there were more tax dollars in the U.S. coffers, it wouldn't go to helping families who need water, right? It would go to tax cuts for the rich. So I think that, you know, we need those things need to happen in tandem to really make change. But I think that when it comes to the issue of, you know, sort of how to move forward, that really comes from knowing that advocacy, being an advocate, is really just being someone who won't go away and won't stop talking. You know, you don't have to be incredibly, you know, you don't have to have special education to do it. You need to be willing to call someone you don't know and tell them what you think. You know, we know that our elected officials respond to us. And if you talk to staffers, both, you know, local, state, or federal, they'll tell you their bosses listen to their constituents, but not all constituents call.
Right.
And so, you know, when you get those emails saying, you know, call your elected official, you should do that because so, it matters.
Let's talk about finally the Biden administration, the Biden-Harris administration that has claimed they care about poverty and inequality, has put forward a progressive tax proposal. 120 Democrats just signed on to a letter demanding the overturning of a new tax break that was buried in the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act that the Republicans passed. They sort of buried these Easter eggs that, in the future, sort of give new tax breaks to the rich. So Democrats are saying they want to tackle inequality. Unfortunately, in the past, Democrats haven't always been trustworthy enough and have been found to be almost as beholden to Wall Street as Republicans. Now they control the Senate, they control the House, they control the presidency. And because tax issues, budgetary issues can actually be passed by simple majority rather than a 60-vote majority, in theory, the Biden administration and Democrats in the House and the Senate have a 2-year window to make a massive difference on economic inequality. So my question to you finally, Colleen, is will they take that chance?
If we make them.
Yeah.
You know, I don't believe in political saviors. I don't believe that people just come from on high and give power back to the people. I think we have to press them. And while certainly I'm encouraged by a lot of the things the Biden administration has put out in its early days, I know that to keep that momentum, we need a population that's really engaged and really sees poverty as a major issue. You know, 10 years ago, people didn't talk about climate change the way they do today. People didn't act on it the way they do today. That's where we are with poverty. We need to push them.
Well, I want to thank the two of you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book. Appreciate your time.
Thank you
so much.
My guests have been Colleen Shaddix, a journalist focusing on criminal justice reform and inequality, who's written for the New York Times, Washington Post, and NPR, and Joanne Goldbloom, CEO and founder of the National Diaper Bank Network and the Alliance for Period Supplies. Both Joanne and Colleen are co-authors of the book we've been discussing, Broke in America, Seeing, Understanding, and Ending U.S. Poverty. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify.